Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Early one fall evening, I answered a loud knock at the door to find several members of the local rescue squad on my front steps. It seems that our 12-year-old, babysitting for his two younger brothers, thought my husband and I had already left for the evening, when a game of tag ended with the 4-year-old bumping his head on a sharp corner. The sight of a good deal of blood, complete with a screaming child, convinced our son that it was wise to summon higher authority. How can we equip our children with the confidence, self-esteem, and information to make smart choices in emergency situations? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Today, our guests will help us prepare our children to cope with emergencies. Chief Richard Long is the District Chief of the Montgomery County, Maryland Department of Fire and Rescue Services. He has two grown sons. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Officer Hugh Packard is School Safety Coordinator for the Bethesda District of the Montgomery County Police Department. He is the father of two daughters, one in high school and one a college freshman. We're glad to have you with us, Officer Pack.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Chief Long, what items should every household have on hand for medical emergencies?
There are a few that every household should have. The first thing would be a basic first aid kit. And it doesn't have to be something that's elaborate or expensive. You can find things in the local pharmacies that you can take home and build your own. So one of the first things you probably would want to have would be 4x4s. These are little gauze pads that you can use if someone is bleeding. Should also have some type of bandaging material. The old heavy Johnson & Johnson tape that's out there is good, but there's also lighter ones, things that can be put on so you can change bandages if there's a small cut or something like that. You may also want to invest in ice packs. There are several makes on the market. There are some that you can put in the freezer. And you can freeze these ahead of time and have them ready for bumps and bruises. And you can also buy ones that are chemical. So if you strike them, it mixes two chemicals together, and they have instant cold. Those are great if you're going to put something like that maybe in an automobile, if you want a first aid kit, or if you're going to be traveling. But really, the cheapest thing to do is buy something that you can just throw in the refrigerator, and you can use that. One of the other things, especially if you want to talk about poisoning, there's something on the market called syrup of Ipecac. And this is a substance that, when taken, will induce vomiting. That could be important depending on the particular medication or maybe the poison that the child has taken. This is something, though, that you shouldn't just give as soon as you think your child's taken something. This has to be under the direction usually of a physician or a local poison control center.
You want to explain why that is?
Well, the problem with syrup of Ipecac is that about 20 minutes after you give it, the child will start to vomit. There are substances that if the child takes could cause additional damage, much worse than actually taking the medication. A good example
by vomiting,
of this, by vomiting, a good example of that would be something like Drano or any of the household really hard cleaners, because once they go down, they've done their damage. But if the child would vomit them back up, now you've got a secondary burn or a secondary problem. Some products like petroleum products, if you gasoline, things like that, if you start to vomit, many times people will try to breathe in at the same time. If you breathe in something that has a petroleum product and it actually gets into the lungs, you could cause what they cause an aspiration pneumonia. That's even more serious. So Ipecac is good, but it needs to be given under the direction of a physician or a poison control center.
Which means probably in the first aid kit should be the poison control number.
You definitely need to have the local poison control number, yes.
Anything else you would add to this?
You might also want to put something like blankets. That should be something that's readily available. If it's 20 degrees or 30 degrees outside and someone has fallen, maybe a child has fallen and hurt themselves, you really don't want to be moving them unless it's pretty obvious that you can pick them up, bring them into the house, and not going to cause any further injury. If you've had a child who's been on the roof, and a lot of kids like to get up on the roofs and run around and they'll try to jump off and imitate certain comic book figures, the problem here is that if there are major injuries, you really don't want to be moving them till the rescue squad arrives. So you'll need the blankets to maintain body heat. So that would be a good idea to have also. There's other things that you may want to put into the first aid kits, but you really need to check maybe with your pediatrician. There are certain drugs that are on the market, maybe Tylenol or also one called Benadryl. A lot of people like to use Benadryl if a child's been stung by a bee, maybe to reduce the amount of itching or the hives, but they really need to check with their pediatrician.
What are the most important things, Officer Packard, for a parent to teach a child who will be home alone with regard to fire and personal safety?
You have to know your child, what they're capable of doing. You cannot assume that any individual, two 10-year-olds, one of them may be very adept at taking care of themselves. If they run into a problem, they're smart enough to realize that it is a problem bigger than what they can handle, and they can make the appropriate phone call. They can call the neighbor that you've had standing by, or they can call 911, whereas the other 10-year-old might use the telephone as a toy and inadvertently call 911. Kids are like night and day, so you have to understand your own child's capability. If you have latchkey kids, there should be a checklist. They ought to have a key available. It shouldn't be hidden around the front door, under the mat. Every burglar in the world knows where to look for keys that are kept in proximity to the house. So that a child that is a latchkey kid that is going to come home after school and need to gain access to the house should have a key with them. It shouldn't be dangling around their neck exposed. It should be on a chain or something long enough to where it can be out of sight so they're not advertising. And they should have a checklist to go through once they get home. As they approach the house, does the house look normal? Are the doors closed? Are windows ajar? Is the door locked? Once they get inside, take a quick look around, and if anything at all looks out of place, immediately leave. They should be at another residence close by where they could go at that time of day and get some help. And that person should also have a spare key for the house. Once they get inside, check in. There should be, by the phone, not only the poison control line, but there should be a list of phone numbers. Again, any child may know the numbers, but in a panic situation, boom, it goes right out the window. So there should be a list right by the phone. Dad's work, mom's work, babysitter, grandparents, poison control, 911, non-emergency phone numbers like the police department, fire department has a non-emergency phone line, I believe. Those kind of things should be available right by the phone, big print, so the kids have access to it. They also should have their own name, the address, and the phone number they're calling from. Once again, panic situation, they're making a 911 call. Where do you live? And kids should be taught when they call 911, it's not magic. You don't pick the phone up and punch 911, and then all of a sudden a fire truck or an ambulance or a police car comes rolling down the street. You're going to have to go through a series of questions, and you're going to get bounced around. Our emergency operations center, fire, police, or rescue, right off the bat, we tell kids you have to make a choice. So as soon as you dial 911, take a deep breath, let it out slowly, and answer the questions. Fire, police, or rescue, you're going to get transferred to another operator, and that operator is going to ask a lot of questions that the child may know very well, but we don't. And tell the kids that they have to explain what's going on. Well, the house is on fire. Whose house? My house. Are you in it? Yes, get out. If there's a strange person at the door, obviously we want them to stay in. And these kind of scenarios, you have to go through with the kids. Along with a first aid kit, if your child's going to be at home, you really need an emergency type kit. What happens if the electricity goes out? Kids get scared. Well, they ought to have a place where there's a flashlight, maybe a portable radio, once again, a blanket. That'd be a good place to keep the first aid kit as well, so that it's all in one place. They know where it is, and you have to talk through what can go wrong. If a kid comes home and they start watching TV and they see something that scares them, and then all of a sudden the wind blows and a window rattles, and all of a sudden we're, well, they have to know that, you know, talk through that. What can be happening, what you should do, or what you shouldn't do.
Years ago when my youngest son was home alone and there was a thunderstorm and all the power went out, we were only gone about an hour. And he had my mother on the phone most of that hour. When we came home, he was on the phone with my mom. The power hadn't gone out in terms of the phone. And so we said, who are you talking to on the phone? He said, well, I've been talking to my grandmother. She makes me feel better. But now that you're home, I can get off the telephone. So yeah. It was a good solution for him, and we were lucky the phone wasn't
Absolutely.
Knocked out.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Chief Long, what are some signals that a situation is a medical emergency? What should we tell a child? This is a medical emergency if this happens.
You know, you're referring to them looking at somebody else or to
mm-hmm.
themselves?
Or themselves, okay. But no parents around.
Mm-hmm. It's really hard to say what actually defines a true emergency. In other words, if we've got to err one way or the other, we'd rather have them call than not call. But if you want to say, tell me what maybe should signal that I need to get some help from 911, obviously if they can't get a response from somebody, the person's unconscious, that's a definite clue. You need to get some help. You need to dial 911. The other thing they should be concerned with is if a younger brother or even an older brother or sister isn't acting normal. In other words, if they're maybe talking but they're not making sense, or if they're having difficulty breathing, or if they're not answering their questions. One of the things that we run into a lot is especially children who are asthmatics and they're home with another child and all of a sudden the child maybe starts to have an asthma attack. Well, a child who's suffering from asthma usually is very quick. It goes from having no problems at all to within the next several minutes being totally short of breath. And what will happen is that child will usually do several things. They'll try to put themselves in what we call the position of comfort. That's usually sitting bolt upright, trying to take deep, slow breaths. And they'll also see them laboring, having a very difficult time breathing. If someone's having trouble breathing, they can't answer the person's questions, they need to dial 911. They need to get some help from them. That along with other things that maybe happen in injuries. In other words, a child's running and they trip and fall. Obviously, bleeding can be very serious. The fortunate thing is that usually bleeding is not as bad as it looks. People panic when they see blood, and that's normal. That's not something we want to see. That's not something that's very comfortable to look at. Usually, small amounts of blood are not going to be life-threatening. More concerning to us is somebody who's bleeding and you can't stop the bleeding. So in other words, if the child's taken a first aid course and they know that I'm supposed to apply direct pressure with gauze or bandages or whatever is available, and that bleeding won't stop, then we've got a very serious problem.
Should children take first aid courses?
It would be an excellent idea. Many of the local school systems now are starting to implement some type of training. First thing they usually start with is CPR. There was a big push years ago that no, only adults should take CPR because it took a lot of skill, it took time, and it really took some mechanical skills they didn't think children have. And they're finding now that they started teaching it in the high schools, and they said, well, it works in the high school, let's try it in the junior highs, and they did it in junior high. Now they're actually even bringing it down into the elementary school level. And they may not be able to do perfect CPR, but at least they can recognize the signs and symptoms of a problem, and they know what to do to maybe open the airway. But even more important, they learn what not to do. So in other words, if someone is unconscious, they learn that you don't put a pillow underneath their head. That just makes things worse. That actually blocks their airway. So they should learn CPR, and like I said, a lot of places will start teaching their children. They can also take first aid courses, and the basic first aid courses are very simple, maybe 20, 30 hours worth of instruction. They teach how to stop bleeding, what not to do as far as also what to do, but they maybe sometimes will include the CPR courses, and they're available through the American Red Cross, and they're also available through a lot of scouting organizations, Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts. So there's a lot of resources out there where they can learn first aid.
About how old should they be when they're taught this?
It's really hard to come up with a particular age because the child themselves have different levels of maturity. Mm-hmm. It is perfectly acceptable, and we'll back up for a minute, is that all children, even when very, very young, should start learning how to dial 911 and be taught that. You know, what the numbers mean and the fact that it's only used in emergencies. And like Officer Packard was saying, is that they need to understand that more questions are going to be asked. You just don't call in and hang up the phone. But that can be started at a very early age. Now when we get into the grade school, it would not be hard to start teaching them how to do some very, very basic type of CPR.
What should we tell our children to do once they've gotten the help they've called for?
Fire rescue people, anytime we get into a situation where there's an accident, a shooting, accidental injury, something along those lines, is find out as much about the injury for fire rescue people, the nature of the injury, but you also don't want a child to be standing there. Let's say mom fell down the steps and she's cracked her head open, and what we tell, I tell the kids in the elementary school, if something like that happens and your mom's on the floor and it looks like she's asleep but won't wake up, you call 911, go through that, and as soon as the fire rescue people there, or in some circumstances, rarely around here, we might get there first. But they're going to have to answer a lot of questions, and then the next thing that we have to do is find out who's going to look after this child while the parent or whoever was injured is taken care of, because in camp situations we've been through, where you see someone that's had a rather serious injury, the last thing in the world you want, especially if that person's conscious, is to have somebody stand there, oh, he's dying. He's going to, you know, he's not going to make it. Well, I don't care how bad off the person is. The first thing you're going to see fire rescue people do, and we do the same thing, is downplay the nature of the injury, just, you know, what happened, try and keep them conscious, get as much information as you can. With kids in particular, it's very traumatizing for any child to see something dramatic or traumatic happen to a loved one, particularly a parent or brother or sister. They need to be kind of removed from the situation, but they can't be left alone because they're going to need some tending to as well, as far as, you know, nurturing type stuff.
A couple of things they can do to help the fire department is if it's at night or if it's dark, especially during the wintertime, turn the front porch light on. Dispatchers will usually tell them to do that, but that helps us. As you're going down the street, every house almost looks the same, and when you're trying to find numbers, and if you see a house where there's only one light on, a lot of times that kind of draws you to it, or it even makes it easier to read the numbers on the house. The other things they can do is, depending on if there's a family pet, a dog, if they can, remove the dog from the premises. So in other words, put him in another room, just close the door. Several things there. Most dogs, even if they don't bite or they've never been aggressive, get scared when a lot of people come running in the house, they hear sirens and things. We need to be able to get in there and not have to worry about whether the dog's going to be excited by all these people rushing into their territory or the sirens that they may be heard. So that helps us a little bit. The other things they can do is that if they know first aid, if they've been taught first aid, see what maybe is appropriate. In other words, can they stop the bleeding? Or can they make the person a little bit more comfortable until the fire department arrives? And they should stay there and be able to answer the questions that the rescuers have. But one of the other things that we really need to instill into the children is that when they dial 911 and they've answered the questions and the dispatcher tells them to hang up, they should hang the phone up and stay off the phone. I know there's always a tendency, I got to call mom, I got to call dad, I've got to call somebody. But within that first 5 minutes, while the rescue units are still responding, there's always the possibility the dispatcher is going to need to get back in touch with them. They may have given the address wrong, or there may be some other factor that the dispatcher needs to know. So it would be better if they could just stay off the phone until the fire rescue people arrive, and then if they need to call somebody else, they can do it at that time.
Officer Packard, what advice do you give children regarding personal safety when they're out of the house?
There's always safety in numbers. We talk, the dangerous stranger concept has been around for years and years, and we try and teach kids that everybody you don't know is a stranger and possibly a dangerous stranger, what the difference is. And the old cliche that you can't judge a book by looking at its cover is extremely appropriate with people, because when I was growing up, the dangerous stranger was the dirty old man in the trench coat, you know, in the park bench. Well, we've learned the hard way that many people that are in situations that are dangerous to children could look like your grandfather, they could look like your brother, your sister. They may be people in a trust situation that you even know, so we have to be careful about that, extremely careful.
What would you consider, then, the optimal age for children to be allowed to go unsupervised to public places?
In this day and age, I don't know that there is a safe age. Unfortunately, Maryland law requires that if there is an 8-year-old or younger at home, they must have a 13-year-old or older to watch after them. Some 13-year-olds are excellent babysitters. Some are not. And to send 14- and 15-year-olds out to malls or places like that completely unsupervised is just not a wise thing to do. I don't know that there is ever a real safe age for that sort of thing. You don't know how your kids are going to react. You don't know what the situation is going to be. Years ago, one of the first cases I worked on was a pair of sisters that disappeared at a local mall, and that case has never been solved. And they were 13 and 11, 12 and 11, something along those lines. And that's 25, 26 years ago. And today, while stranger abduction is relatively rare, it's still a real possibility.
Citing a case like this, of course, brings terrible fears to parents, but do you feel that there are certain times of day that are better than others? For example, that daytime is better for kids to do those kinds of things than nighttime?
Once again, it depends on the circumstance. I personally, as a parent, if my kids are going to go out, they're going to have to answer 20 questions. Where are you going? Who are you going with? And, you know, just going to the mall and hanging out, that's not going to get it. If you have a specific place to go, if you're going to the movies or we're going to so-and-so's house, you know, that's verifiable. And you have a time frame. If somebody's going to the movies, you know that they're in all likelihood going to be done an hour and a half, 2 hours later, and you can make arrangements for transportation or whatever. But kids just left roaming is an accident looking for a place to happen. Something may happen to them, but more often they're going to start meeting people that are maybe older, maybe more involved in alcohol and other drug abuse, and kids that have a totally different lifestyle that may be appropriate for them, it may not. So I recommend, you know, really, you can't just turn your kids loose in a mall or in a neighborhood without any sense of direction. And kids basically want direction. They want guidelines. They may try and stretch the parameters that you set down, but they do want parameters. And parents, you have to be involved. You have to know where they're going and let them know that you care and go that way with it.
Well, you both have either made parents very nervous or much calmer. We're betting on calmer. Chief Richard Long and Officer Hugh Packard, thank you both for giving us such helpful advice. We're going to continue this discussion on our next program. For our listeners' poll question coming up next, please call our toll-free number, 1-800-791-8573. That's 1-800-791-8573. And give us your response. Here is the question. What do you find hardest about raising children? We'd like to use some of your comments on the air, but if you'd prefer, you need not leave your name or phone number. We'd like to hear from you.
If you have other comments, questions, or suggestions for Parents Perspective, you can use the toll-free number 1-800-791-8573. Or email us at parentspur@aol.com or contact us care of this station. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.